this, and the great news is never truly reported. The significant little items that float like withered leaves in that soft, humid hair of all eternity. For example, there's a hen, a simple, honest little hen owned by Neil Murray of Stamford, Maine, that lays empty eggs. Yes, lays empty eggs. Always reaching, always striving, always hoping, always playing for the best. That's the way. All right, now, give me the first cut. Cue up the first cut there. You can't get loving when there ain't any love. What are you doing in there, Walker, crying out loud? Looks like a track meet going on. You know, yeah, you know, speaking of track meets, I suppose you keep abreast of these little things that are floating in the wind. And in the New York Times, you remember those days when there was a paper and all? Well, oh, speaking of the paper, I am walking along 42nd Street not more than a half an hour ago, and I see this big crowd of guys standing around the newsstand there. And behind the newsstand is this heavy-set guy with the jowls and with the beard, and he's hollering. He's hollering things like, "Get your latest paper here. Get your latest paper, Washington, and all points west, east, and north, and south. World news here. Get your latest paper." And all these guys are standing up there buying papers as fast as they can slap down their dough. And all the guys that I see are these racetrack-looking tout-type guys, you know? The guys that are trying to figure out what happened at Hialeah today, obviously. And they've got checkered suits. They have striped shirts. These guys got neon-lit ties, and they're all standing in line there. And what do you think they're buying? "Hey, let's go, Walter." "No, no, don't worry about that one. It's the one that's up now. Hold it now." "Oh, gee, for crying out, watch me, Walter, not that turntable." So what do you think they're buying? These guys are lined up there, and they're slapping down their dough, and there's a guy standing in line there, handing them out as fast as he can, and these racetrack guys are trying to find out what happened at Hialeah by buying the latest edition of the Christian Science Monitor. "You can get water where there ain't any water." That's easy. Just calm down. "You can get rain where there ain't any water." All together now, gang. "You can get honey where there ain't any water." Oh! "You can get honey where there ain't any water." All right, there. Cut it out there. There you are. You're okay. Well, you know, tonight I have, since the Christmas season is rapidly approaching, I'm constantly being confronted with the problem of whether or not to continue our great vast public service and tell you about things that are now available on the various Christmas lists, or to ignore the entire situation. Speaking of ignoring the entire situation, I'd like to read you a little note that came from last week's issue. In fact, it was Sunday, the 2nd of December, New York Times. And it had to do with, an issue of our time. And the article, the little note says, "Emendation. Shakespeare recently ran into a conflict of interest, at least in the minds of those putting together a television program. While editing pieces of film containing varied types of entertainment, the producers were suddenly struck by a line from Hamlet, in which Polonius advised his son Laertes, 'Neither a borrower nor a lender be.'" Neither a borrower nor a lender be. The line was immediately eliminated. It wouldn't have seemed right on a program sponsored by the Friendly Savings and Loan Organization. Now, hold it there. It was like the time. Do you know that it actually happened one time right here in these friendly United States that they were doing a program based on the Civil War, and they had to eliminate all references to Lincoln because the program was sponsored by a rival motor car.
Eyes of blue,
eyes of blue, but she's got eyes of blue, and that's my weakness now.
She's got white cheeks,
I never cared for dimpled cheeks, but she's got dimpled cheeks, and that's my weakness now. Oh, my. Oh, me.
you know, one way or the other. You know, speaking of amending things, which most of us do in our... Oh, yes, we must have. Speaking of deletions, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. And I have to get the business out of the way as soon as possible. And while I'm doing that, you can queue up all the records, Walt, calmly. You got a good 2.5 minutes. All right, now, let's see. Here, I'll give you the cue. Pow. Show. Now, Show Magazine is probably the first successful magazine about the arts to come along in many, many years. It just hasn't been a good magazine that covers the field of the arts. Most of them are pretentious, many of them are dull, and almost all of them up to this point have been pointless. And certainly the production has been lacking in most magazines in America today anyway. They're getting to be nothing but a whole series of badly printed ads. I would suggest you look at Show Magazine, and it makes a great Christmas gift. For $5.75, you can send a copy of Show to somebody every month of the year, and it is really a beautiful magazine. I've gotten all kinds of letters from people who have taken our advice about this thing, and invariably they say they are all amazed at how beautiful this magazine is put together, and it actually does have viewpoint, which surprises them. What are you worried about? I've got plenty of time. Don't worry about it. So if you would like to take advantage of this $5.75 per year, just send your name and address to Show in care of WOR, New York, New York. And they will send along a beautiful card to whomever you decide to send it to. Show, WOR, New York, New York, $5.75 a year. Okay? Now, we have also with us Mandarin House, which is a superb Oriental restaurant. It's very difficult to tell people about Oriental food, really good Oriental food, and I'm not going to presume to try to tell you. Some people, in fact, I know many people who do not think food is good, really good, quality gourmet cuisine, unless it is French. There is this type of snobism, also this type of ignorance. Perhaps you are not aware that there are certain types of Oriental cookery that are considered among true gourmets as being the equivalent, if not surpassing, what they call the high cuisine of France. And this is generally considered to be Mandarin food. And if you haven't tried it, I would like to respectfully suggest you do so and do it well and right. The Mandarin House is on 13th Street between 6th and 7th in the village. Superb food. They're open 7 days a week, and they have a bar. Okay? By the way, call before you go down. It might be easier to get a table. Mandarin House. All right, now we're back in business now. You know, for a long time, I have been debating telling the story of the... I'm debating right here tonight now, since it's one of those nights. I'm debating whether or not to tell the story of the Great Ice Cream War or to tell the story about the time that Albert Farkas trapped me in the A&P. I don't know which to tell, because both of them are relevant to a certain set of conditions and circumstances under which we find ourselves almost momentarily in our world today. I feel that bravery is not always bravery. I also feel that cowardice is not always cowardice. And I'm debating which story to tell here. Now, I could also tell you about the time that I first learned the actual texture, the actual nature of treachery. I can tell you about that time. Well, I'll tell you that one briefly, because, you know, most of us are not aware of what treachery is, you know. We like to think that treachery comes about through sneaky people. We like to think that treachery comes about through righteousness being undone by unrighteousness or evil, right? This is the way we think of treachery. Has it ever occurred to you that you, being a right-thinking person, could be very well guilty of the worst kind of treachery? Yes, that your rightness is not rightness at all. It is self-interest, which can be very, very terrible, unraveling. It's awfully unraveling to the psyche to discover that what you considered righteousness, honesty, reliability, sobriety, uprightness, and all of it is just plain, ordinary, crummy priggishness. You know? You're just a scared to be anything else. Well, I'll tell you, one time, you learn these things very early, and tonight I think we'll do a brief notary program on education as opposed to real education. You know what we call real education, like English 202B, like Thomas Hardy through Beowulf, or Beowulf through Thomas Hardy, or would you prefer to take the five basic philosophies of Western thought plus the sixth one that nobody talks about and the seventh one that everybody acts on and never even suggests that it exists? Would you prefer that? Well, let me tell you, one time I'm this kid, you know, and I don't know how it feels now, of course, doing a radio show and coming in late is a failure, not against anything but yourself. Now, I have been late many times, but I remember clearly and distinctly the time that I discovered the nature and the very feel and the taste of treachery. I arrived, I was a hitchhiker. Now, this was during the Depression, and I had just, well, it wasn't really during the Depression, it was at the end of the days of the Depression, and it was before I had any money that made any noise in my pocket. And I was about 3 or 4 miles from school. Now, it has to be explained, first of all, this is very important. The logistics of life are very important to us. If you live next door to the bear trap, that's one thing. But if you have to travel 45 miles to get caught in the bear trap, somehow it is a worse trapping. It's just worse. Well, every day there were about six of us kids. Have you ever hitchhiked? One of the most exciting things you can do in life, strangely enough, is hitchhiking. Hitchhiking is truly an adventure. I'm talking about from the standpoint of the hitchhiker himself. Hitchhiking is like fishing. You never know what you're going to hook. Or if anything, you can be skunked, you know, and not do anything and wind up just standing around and finally getting in the streetcar. You're skunked. But then on the other hand, you can get into this beautiful, magnificent car driven by a spectacular blonde and live beyond your wildest dreams for the next 26 minutes while you're being taken to wherever it is you're being taken to, which happened to me on two occasions. I will tell you about the time the woman picked me up in the Chrysler Airflow, and I'm this little innocent kid. I must have been about 14, see? And I'm out there with my thumb out, you know, and I'm hitchhiking down. I'm strictly the kind who gets embarrassed when you ask Esther Jane Albury whether she wants to go to the dance with you, you know, and you stand around outside wondering whether you should go in, and you itch a little bit, and you pop out in hives and that, and you finally get in, and they're playing Red Sails in the Sunset, and you march around sort of heavily, and underneath the backboard you go, and, you know, and you back out again, and you can smell the old tennis shoes over there in the gym, you know, and that kind of world, you know. It was very, I'm a kid, you know, I'm a kid. Well, I had dreams of glory, it's true. From time to time, I would read Spicy Western in the basement down in the, yes, in the coal bin. I had, you know, I'll never forget the time I hid the Spicy Western, and I had also some Spicy Detectives, which I hid under the coal. There was a lot of coal, you see, and we never ran out of coal. We would always skim the coal down to the bottom. Well, one day, they didn't deliver the coal. And we went all the way down to the bottom, and my old lady found about 15 Spicy Westerns, about 7 Spicy Detectives, 7 Captain Billy's Whizbangs, and 4 books, which I can't even describe to you on the air here. Well, she knew my old man wasn't reading them. Or if he was, he wasn't hiding them in the coal bin. Well, I want to tell you what happened that afternoon. Well, it wasn't really what happened that afternoon. It was what didn't happen that afternoon. It was I came rushing home from school, you know. I was wanted to catch up on my reading. And it was about 4 o'clock, and I go down to the basement, and I start groping around in the coal, and there is no coal. Just a few old lumps there, you see, and it was nothing else. Oh, boy. Well, that's another problem, you know. This produces all... It could produce Tennessee Williams. It could produce Hemingway. It could produce Ted Williams, you know. All the aggressions come out at once. Well, anyway, one day, I'll tell you about the adventures of a hitchhiker. Someday somebody's going to write this stuff up. I mean, the adventures of a kid hitchhiker. I'm standing out there hitchhiking to school, you know. And here, it was really a very simple and a very innocent thing. I used to get money to go to school, to ride the bus. Now, I wasn't poor. My mother would give me the dough for the bus, and she'd say, here's the money. Every day, I would get the dough, which was 20 cents. It was 10 cents each way. That was what the special school kid rate, you know. So she would say, here's 20 cents. Now, it was an open-ended contract. My only responsibility was to get to school. There was not a responsibility to ride that crummy bus. It was get to school. So I used to go tearing my thing down to the corner, you know, with about six other guys, and the wind is howling through the telephone wires, and we're standing there, and there was this main road that went into where we went to school, and we're all out there hitchhiking. It was a whole bunch of kids who were knocking down 20 cents a day. We would save the 20 cents, and then, of course, you could squirt it any way you wanted to with the 20 cents is the way you made your dough. Well, it was very, very risky because you're like a stock player playing on margin. You understand that? That if you were late, you had no excuse. You had 20 cents in your pocket, you were late. Well, let me tell you what I did one day. I hate to disseminate the story, but it was really two partial things. I'll tell you why hitchhiking was very exciting other than the 20 cents, because it got into your blood. Being a bum, you know, gets into your blood. It's like living off danger. It gets very exciting. To a guy who started out, you know, I wondered, because there were a whole lot of kids who had the same 20 cents given to them. Kids I knew. You know, I'm getting to have a revelation here. This is very scary. There were a lot of kids I knew in school with me who had no more dough than I did, who had just as many wild hobbies and ambitions as I did, but who every day took their 20 cents and got into the bus. There were about seven of us who couldn't do it. We did not ride in that bus for four straight years in high school. It just seemed to be the natural thing to do, to play it cool and to live off danger. And I can tell you what happened out of that seven guys, you'd never guess. Not one guy, to my knowledge, has a job that you could call a job of security. Not one. One guy was killed in the Air Force. Two guys of the crowd were killed in the Air Force. What do you think happened to them? They could have become company clerks. One guy becomes a navigator, and the other guy became something else in the Air Force. Both of them lasted about 20 minutes in combat. The other four of us, boy, I can tell you what I know of the other three guys. Well, you know what I'm doing. It's living on the edge of the abyss all the time. I think it goes back to those hitchhiking days. It just suddenly occurred to me. Well, every morning, we're out there, you see, and it's exciting. The sun would be shining, or there would be a snowstorm or something, and you're going out to the lake. You're going to fish. And we're standing there hitchhiking. It goes, whew, car goes past, and you look, wah, 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 and then, whew, wah, 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 wah. At once, you know, we'd be all out in line, and we had a regular seniority system. The first guy in the corner, of course, was the first guy in line. And they would be strung out after that, you know, the idea being that most generally a car would come along and pick up the first kid instead of driving past eight kids and pick up the guy in the end. It would never work like that. So you'd work your way up. You see, once in a while you'd see Flick would get a great ride, or Schwartz would get a great ride. And once in a while some guy would come along and say, "All you kids, come on, get in the back, all of you, all of you, all of you." There'd be 27 kids piled up in the back of this Hupmobile, you know, all of them hollering and yelling. Okay, that was okay. But what we liked was the individual thing, you see. The gang ride was not good, but we wanted the, you know, each guy. So we would compare. Flick would get an old Ford, somebody would get a Chrysler Airflow. Ah, Chrysler Airflow today. Flick, Packard, Twomp. You know, it was like fishing, see. Well, one day, and you can understand why this happened, one day I'm hitchhiking home. Hitchhiking home was not as dangerous. You could fool around a little bit, you know. After all, there was no deadline. Well, I'm hitchhiking one day, all by myself. I'm late, I'm at football practice or something, and so I'm by myself, and along came this Chrysler Airflow. Do you remember the Chrysler Airflow? Well, the Chrysler Airflow, you see, was kind of, it's hard to describe, it was, in the minds of the population of the period, it was kind of like the Jaguar of its day. Oh, yes, it was a very exotic car. It was in, you know, the Depression, and a Chrysler Airflow comes along, and it stopped for me. And I go running, it, you know, went about 20 feet past me, and I turn, I run, I open the door, and here is this very, very pretty girl. Well, of course, she looked like an older lady to me. She was probably 20. Well, she looked like an older lady to me, but a very interesting older lady. You know, she sits there behind the wheel there, and I get in the front seat of the car, and we start down the street. And she says, "Where are you going?" I said, Hessville. You always said that apologetically, you know. It's like saying Hackensack or something now, you know, Hessville. She said, "Oh, very interesting." So we rode for a while in silence. She said, "I bet you must be cold." I said, "Yeah, it's kind of cold. It's pretty warm in here, though." "Yeah, pretty warm, yeah." She said, "Well, how would you like to stop and warm up a little before you go home?" I said, "What?" "Well, what do you mean?" She says, "Well, I live just the other side of Hessville. How would you like to roast some marshmallows before you go home? Well, I'm very innocent, you know, and I said, gee, that's a pretty good idea. And we rode about another half a mile. And she's driving this car, and it's a Chrysler Airflow. And it's very fascinating. Well, gee, wild. You know, it's a beautiful thing. But I was sitting there, you know, it's got floating action. Did you ever hear of floating action? Well, it had floating action and freewheeling. See, I wanted to ask her to throw in the freewheeling. See, it was a kid of interest and all that. Throw in the freewheeling, baby. Let's try the freewheeling there. You know, it had a big thing that you pull out, just freewheeling. See, and I'm looking at the freewheeling thing there. And all of a sudden, she says, say, why don't you come over and sit next to me? I turn and say, hey, well, I scrunched over, and I'm sitting next to this older lady, who was roughly, well, she was an older lady in the Sandra Dee sense. You see, I'm sitting there, you know, and we get up there, we're coming up to the corner where I usually got off, you know, and this is, and we're going to go past my house, you know, and I said, let me off at Kennedy Street here. I'll get off Kennedy. I have a paper route. I gotta. She says, don't you want to roast marshmallows? I said, I've got cavities. She says, well, we don't have to roast marshmallows. We can just warm up. I can give you some cider. Well, you know, it's funny. I had no suspicion of what was going on except that something was happening inside of me. Overload relays were kicking out all over the place. And I was having a very strange reaction, mentally, physically, every other way. I had never thought this way about marshmallows or cider. She said, well, you sure you don't want to stop by? I said, no. Well, we stopped at the corner of Kennedy and Summer, and I got out of the car, and I closed the door, and she leaned over, and she really leaned over, and she ran the window down. She says, are you sure now before I go? Well, it was one of the first times in my life that I wasn't sure of anything. Kids are pretty sure of stuff, you know. There's nothing more arbitrary than a kid's decision on anything. Ah, it's love stuff, kids will say. That's the way they deal with all of sex. Love stuff. You know, that's it. Well, I was pretty arbitrary up to that time. Or when somebody would say, you're going to the party, the Valentine party. Ah, girls! Well, you had answers. Boy, let me tell you, I walked home and it was winter. I was sweating all the way. I was sweating. It was popping out of my ears. My eyeballs were sweating. Well, so you understand why I dug hitchhiking. Okay. Now, this is why I dug hitchhiking. Hitchhiking was very exciting. You know, you never knew what was going to happen. So I'm out there one day, see, and I'm hitchhiking. And I'm, you know, I'm making a scene out there. I'm hitchhiking away. And I got my hot 20 cents in my pocket. Well, nothing is happening. The cars are going past. Now, this had happened on several occasions, but this was a more serious occasion because, you know, when you're a transgressor and there are 15 other transgressors, somehow it isn't as bad. But when you're transgressing alone, it is a serious proposition. Everybody has gotten a ride, and I am the last one. Usually, we would get rides in twos and threes and fours. This time, I'm alone, and I'm hitchhiking. It's now 10 minutes to 8. We are due at school at 8:15, and I know that it takes at least 20 minutes to get there. I'm hitchhiking, frantically. I'm out there, old Thomas going, phew. I look at my watch, my Mickey Mouse. And then I see there's a bus coming. And it's not the bus, the school bus. It is the city bus, you see. And it's my last chance. My last chance, and it's an outside one. Well, I'm standing there. And the bus... and he goes off into the distance. I'm going all the way. I'm going in over the horns today. Well, like that. Well, it's now 8:10, and I know I am S-U-N-K, sunk. And a car comes around the corner. I hitchhike. He slows up and stops. This guy's got no valves anywhere, but everything is going. And it's a Dodge. He says, "Hey, kid, where are you going?" I said, "I'm going into Hammond High." "All right, hop in, kid. You're coming up to Cayman Avenue. I'll drop you off at Calumet and home." We go down the street. Well, let me tell you, it's like a covering wagon going against the wind. And you can't tell a guy, for crying out loud, will you kick this bucket? You know, he's hitching, you're sitting in the front seat, and he's, "All right, right, yeah. You know, kid, I went to Hammond High, for crying out loud. Oh, Huffine's still there. Oh, the old slop, for crying out loud." And he's talking away there, and I'm sitting there, and I'm watching that road. That road is unreeling like an arthritic worm under me, you know, and it just goes. "Hey, kid, hold on a minute." He said, "Will you signal out the sign there? I'm going to turn." He's turning in now. And I put my arm out, and we go into this filling station. Well, he's one of these clowns, you know, that talks to the guy. He gets out immediately and goes in and talks, you know. He's looking at the batteries. He's, you know, he's flubbing around. They come out. They check the oil. He hasn't checked the oil since last Easter. You know how he's checking the oil? He's checking the oil. They get the hydrometer out. They check the antifreeze, you know. He's had the same antifreeze in this thing since 1923. And it doesn't matter if it freezes. It's even a block on it, you know. And the car's going, I'm in the front seat, you know, and the time is ticking by. It's now 8:30, and I'm sunk. Oh, my God, I'm sunk, you know, and I want to jump out and run out and start hitchhiking on the street again. I want to go out there and start hitchhiking for a car instead of this bucket. And he was such a nice guy. He's running around. Finally, he gets in. He said, "We're back out on the street." And it was one of these cars. You know the kind of car that when it's wintertime and the windows are closed, it sets up an oscillation inside it, and you go... When the guy's talking to you, he says... He's got a bad AC hum, you know, and I'm talking... Yeah, Miss Snyder's still there, yeah. And I was smelling alky. It's one of those cars, you know, that smells like alky inside and old gas and inner tubes, you know, and that kind of... And it's got all piles of chains on the floor where you sit there, stuff piled up, and old coffee containers and all the junk, you know, and the handprints all over the windshield. I'm telling you, it was like... I mean, you talk about the myth of Sisyphus. Let me tell you, Dad, I was working everything in that car all at once, and I could see, you know, I could see the high school is like a half a mile away, and it's not moving. And all the while, his clown is going, he's talking to me with that oscillation going on. Well, a high school, when you are approaching it, and you are late, and you are an honorable, upright, sober, industrious kid who has been playing it too close to the vest, and who has goofed off with the 20 cents, the hot 2 dimes in his pocket, the high school looks as silent as the Great Pyramid of Giza. It is just silent, and you feel debauched. You feel like you've done something, you know, and you could see just little forms, and everybody's working away. It's quiet. There isn't a soul stirring. And this thing is coming down. Well, immediately my mind takes two courses. Are you going to go all the way and just go right in and go to the Orpheum and see Merle Oberon? You know, play it, because, you're going on. Or are you going to try to aim for that one tiny chance that you can brazen it through? Well, guess which one I took. You don't even have to guess. We pull up down there by Holman Street. I said, "Take me a block past." We stop. I get out of this clunker, And I get down, you know, and your knees are very bad. Your knees start get funny when you ride in an old Dodge that has an oscillation problem. And I go, you feel like Leon Errol, and I go staggering. Away he goes into the distance. That wonderful clown. And I look at the high school, see, and immediately my mind starts to calculate. Remember, we are all part of the same animal race. We are calculators. We are calculators right down to the last fingernail shaving. We really are. No matter how wonderful and altruistic you think you are, you're going to play it for self-interest every time when the chips are down. Well, I decide what I'm going to do is to go around the back of the school. Now, there was a garage in the back of the school, one of these great big long concrete structures where they had a couple of trucks and things. I could walk around the side, go through the garage, down into the basement, and up into the swimming pool area. Now, I knew Mr. Burris in the swimming pool, and I could go in and see Mr. Burris and talk to Mr. Burris and tell Mr. Burris that I have sprained my ankle running across the field, and I've been sitting over there by the grandstands, and my ankle is sprained, and would he please give me a note? Well, of course, this is an insane, ridiculous, rotten scheme. You know how kids will reach for these schemes, you know. Well, I was still a kid. I was just saying, this is part of education. I figured that I could do it. Well, I walk into the garage, playing to anything that is live. It's a kind of a contact, you know. And Stanley said to me, well, you know, kid, take it easy. You know what? Being late isn't anything. I said, yeah, you're right. It really isn't. I'm going to go in and I'm going to be late. He said, listen, why don't you write a note? I want to tell you, I am an honest kid. I had never in my life signed the report card, written a note. I had lied, but I have never done anything like this. And I said, write a note? He said, yeah, why don't you write a note from your mother? Well, this is a grown-up. And so I take out my notebook. I've got all this junk. I says, yeah. Well, I wrote down, please excuse Gene for being late. There is an illness at home, and he was needed this morning. Signed, Mrs. Shepherd. Mr. Standish signed it for me. Well, I took my note, and I felt great, you know. It was just a wonderful thing. A piece of paper in your hand always makes you feel as though you are somehow protected from the wrath of the gods. Well, I walked down through the gym, and I walked right up to the first floor, walked right up to the second floor, and I could see my home room. And it's quiet. You know, the halls are just like a tomb. Well, I walk right on through, and you remember there's about a five-minute time lag between the time that I have seen Standish and the time I am now up here at room 220. So, there's room 220. And in room 220 was little Miss Snyder. Miss Snyder was my homeroom teacher. She was a master in English. And she was the head of the English department. And like all ladies who at an early age are subjected to too much Jane Austen, she had an ironical look in the eye, always. Rimless glasses, gray hair. She was tiny, about 4'10". And Miss Snyder is in there talking, and the kids are sitting there waiting, and it is just before the first class is about to begin. I walk in, and Miss Snyder looks up from her desk, and she says, oh, Gene, would you go down to see Mr. Rupp, please? There was a look in her eye. Mr. Rupp was the assistant principal. He was the Adolf Eichmann of Hammond High. Mr. Rupp? Yes. And she just turned. Didn't look another, not even a glance at me, just turned. I turned around. The hall was 400 miles long now. I could smell that oil that they put on the floors. I'm walking down the hall, down the stairs, heading towards the office. Well, I guess what it is, it's about... It's about a football team. It's about eligibility. I go in through the door, and there was Miss Matson, who was the office girl. I said, Miss Matson, she said, you're a shepherd, aren't you? I said, yes, yes. Mr. Rupp is waiting. Mr. Rupp is waiting. I walk into Mr. Rupp's office, and Mr. Rupp looked kind of like, if you can imagine, a sort of gray-haired LaGuardia. Jovial, but iron. And I walked in, sort of grinning, and he said,
you're Shepherd, aren't you?
I said, yeah, yes.
Mr. Standish called.
What? Mr. Standish called. Mr. Standish called. Mr. Standish, what? I'm the Sheik of Arabia. Oh, your love belongs to me. Tonight, when you're asleep, into your tent I'll creep, creep, creep. Sheik Arabia. Your love belongs to me. Well, to make a long story short, I learned the texture, the taste, the salty taste of a true traumatic experience. You know that funny taste you get in your mouth when you put your tongue on a battery? Yeah, the electrolysis process. Believe me, I was spitting salt water for 2 weeks. My eyes were glazed well into my junior year. It wasn't until I had made corporal 3 times that I began to realize the enormity of the lesson that I had learned. Mr. Standish had called Mr. Rupp immediately. Immediately upon signing my note. And I said to Mr. Rupp, Mr. Standish, who's he? He said, Mr. Standish is Mrs. Jean P. Shepherd. You know very well who Mr. Standish is. I didn't realize until years later that I had looked face to face. I had stood toe to toe with the devil. Yes, I know very well who Mr. Standish is. I know very well now who he is. Yes, I, along with Dr. Faustus, have faced Mephistopheles. And along with Dr. Faustus, I sold out for a mess of pottage. My good name, my youth, my righteous world. Yes, I know who Mr. Standish is, Mr. Robinson.